Court will proceed to the fourth case, Molina versus Cooper.
Charts were helpful.
They certainly were.
Ann will explain those to us later. Mr. Fox.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Ed Fox. I represent the plaintiff's appellates. This case is here upon a grant for summary judgment. This is a Section 1983 action primarily concerning itself with a search warrant and the execution of that search warrant. The primary issue on appeal challenges the district court's finding that the plaintiffs did not make a substantial preliminary showing that the facts making up the search warrant affidavit were supported by probable cause and that they were not, in fact, misrepresented in the search warrant. The plaintiffs here are also appealing the findings on the knock and announce, the use of the concussion bombs in the residence, and the finding that it was sheer speculation, according to the district court, where the plaintiffs identified a single defendant, Mr. Cooper, as having damaged a truck.
When you say concussion, are these hand grenades, whatever they are, do they actually stun or do they just make a noise and flash a light?
Well, I think they do both because they actually cause damage, physical damage to the property and the residence. They cause burning of the carpeting and they destroyed the carpeting where they were thrown. So if they were to hit you, they'd stun you and they caused a big flash bang. So it's my understanding they caused a big flash and a loud noise as well.
What do you mean if they hit you? If it explodes near you, does that cause concussion or just a noise and a flash?
I don't know what the damage would be if you're near it. All I know is
you call it a concussion bomb. Now you're saying you don't know whether it actually causes concussion.
That's what the defendants called it in their testimony. Uh-huh. That's why I use that terminology. In connection with the search warrant, the test to successfully challenge a search warrant is to make an offer proof showing that the facts making up the search warrant affidavit were either deliberately false or made with reckless disregard to the truth. A person challenging a search warrant, according to U.S. v. Franks, is to show specific facts and make a particularized showing that the facts contained in the search warrant were either false or misrepresented recklessly. In this case, the search warrant affidavit and its truthfulness and credibility were strongly challenged on every material point that the defendant, Mr. Cooper, chose to place into the search warrant. The most strongly disputed facts, which the district court rejected as being reasonably disputed, were the facts supplied by an informant by the name of Jason Ramirez. At the time that Jason Ramirez became an informant, he had just been arrested for an aggravated battery charge, and he was in jail on that charge. He then was asked to make a statement, which he made a statement, and these resulted in two statements, which were tape recorded, and we obtained transcripts of these statements. The search warrant failed to disclose, and not only failed to disclose that Jason Ramirez was, at the time of his statement, under arrest for an aggravated battery charge, it also failed to disclose that, notwithstanding the fact that he significantly implicated himself and significant drug activity, he was released from jail immediately after giving a statement, and he didn't even have to put up a bond to get his release. As a result of this...
Why would that have any effect on a magistrate?
Well, it would have an effect not only because...
On the contrary, because the natural inference to draw would be that the police trusted Ramirez.
Well,
that's why they released him.
Well, they might trust Ramirez, but the fact that he had just had an aggravated assault on
his
girlfriend...
That's a different point. The question is, why would the fact that the police released him make the magistrate less willing to grant a warrant, issue a warrant?
Because it looks like, you're saying the inference is that they trust him. The inference might be is they're doing him a favor and acting in cahoots with him and getting him to say what they need him to say. And in fact, when you let a man who has just been arrested on an aggravated battery charge and his girlfriend's in the hospital, and he's just implicated himself in serious drug activity, leave without even having to post a bond, you may say you could trust him, but you also trust him by putting up a bond and making the trust a little bit more realistic in that situation. And we're dealing with a criminal here, not somebody who's on the same team as the police officers, and that's how they treated him. And when you treat somebody, a criminal informant, as if he's on your team, Then you have a reason not to trust his motive, and he has a motive to lie and say whatever he thinks is appropriate because now he's gotten out of jail, and that's why a magistrate shouldn't trust not having that information. And I might add that the district court mentioned...
I don't understand how the magistrate could have refused the warrant when Ramirez's statement, true or false, was so detailed, and he did say these things, and...
Well, that was the problem, and on its face, I'm not arguing with the search warrant on its face, but when you get behind the search warrant, he didn't say a lot of the things that the search warrant says he said, and every single thing that the search warrant said he said was contradicted, everything, and there's no exception, but everything he said was either contradicted or he flat out didn't say at all, and I'll give you an example. The search warrant makes a big deal of the fact that he said that he distributed 27 ounces of cocaine a week from Moline and 50 pounds of marijuana. In fact, in his first statement, he said 3 to 7 ounces, depending on how you read it. Then in the second statement, the amounts became exaggerated. He said a kilo a week. Then he said a kilo a month. And then the officers came up with the 27 ounces a week on their own, somehow deciphering what was said. So they said 27 ounces a week, and then Ramirez agreed with that statement. On the 50 pounds of cannabis a week, Ramirez said that at one time, then he denied that at another time, then he gave a third figure another time, and even Defendant Cooper admitted in his deposition that he had problems with Mr. Ramirez's statement on the marijuana because he was so inconsistent on this, and his words were, this cast a doubt on his statement. But not only did he have problems with his statement on the marijuana, he had problems with his statement on everything, and Illinois v. Gates teaches that you're supposed to put in all the facts, you know, surrounding an affiant's knowledge and the informant's knowledge of what's going on. And if the affiant has doubts about a statement given by an informant, then that's the sort of information that should be placed into the search warrant. And there's problems here. We're investigating them and so forth and so on. And if you get the affidavit, fine. If you don't, then you have to continue on with your investigation.
What evidence do you have that the officers knowingly and intentionally falsified the warrant showed reckless disregard? You're pointing to the inconsistencies. That's the basis for that.
Correct. And that goes to the reckless disregard prong. The knowingly part is that there's a second informant, Jason Villa. And Jason Villa, we were able to get him in a deposition. And he testified that his statement was manipulated by Defendants Cooper and Robbie Dale by repeatedly turning off and on the tape recorder. And then whatever things he said bad about Mr. Molina, he was forced to say those things bad because they threatened to arrest his girlfriend who was right there and hadn't committed any crimes. So he testified under oath at his deposition that he was coerced to do this. So to answer your question, that was the evidence that there was some deliberate falsehoods placed upon the affidavit. The district court tried to disregard that by disowning and disregarding Jason Villa entirely because that was so clearly disputed. But when you're doing a qualified immunity analysis, which is part and parcel of this summary judgment motion, I think you still have to consider that you have a grave credibility issue, and you have to consider credibility. And if the credibility of Defendant Cooper is being challenged in connection with Jason Villa, then I think it brings to bear the credibility of him in connection with all the informant's information. And when you have a man who, Defendant Cooper, who admitted that he had doubt about Ramirez's testimony in several instances, and in fact in the tape statements, he says, I'm confused several times by what you're saying, but he never put that information into the warrant, then you have somebody that's, you know, reckless in the context of the facts that he's placing into there. There were other, the district court accused me of taking out of context and misquoting the testimony from the statements, and I don't want to be accused of that, so what I tried to do in the briefs is quote at length the statements that were given and take and put everything into context to show that there was not a single fact, there really, truly not a single fact that wasn't contradicted or in fact was not true. Another statement that was made was that Mr. Ramirez claimed to have seen a kilo of cocaine at Raul Molina's house, but when you read the statement really closely, you see that they tried to get him to say that. And then Mr. Ramirez denied saying that, and he said, oh, it must have been a kilo of marijuana. And so that's a false statement that's also contained in the affidavit. And there truly is not an exception to anything, including the structure of this organization he's describing, which was contradicted as well from statement to statement. So with that, And we're here on summary judgment, and I'm just suggesting to the court, based upon the evidence that was adduced between Jason Villa and Jason Ramirez, you have so much problems with the information that was not recorded in the warrant. I would be hard-pressed to imagine any judge or magistrate that was hearing this on the criminal side that wouldn't say, we need to have a hearing and decide, you know, what was actually true and what wasn't true in connection with this, and at least make a determination. But by granting summary judgment, the judge takes away even the right to have a hearing on information that was demonstrably false and demonstrably inconsistent, and a fair reading of those statements show that the information contained in the warrant, in the statements, is inconsistent with the information contained in the warrant. The next issue that I'd like to bring up is the issue of the knock and announce. The defendants indicated that the knock and announce was appropriate because they gave it. They said their defense was that Jackie Molina's testimony on this issue was incompetent because she was sleeping. Problem with that is the defendant did the search after midnight, and obviously it's anticipated that the people in the house are going to be sleeping. It's a reasonable inference. That's why they do the search at that time. She testified she was sleeping and that all she heard was screaming, and that the first thing she knew, she woke up and there was a gun to her head. From that, they say the testimony is incompetent to say there was no knock and announce. I would submit, Your Honor, that conclusion's erroneous, and there was nothing incompetent about her testimony whatsoever. The knock and announce is mandated by law to give persons inside a residence the opportunity to reasonably get up and answer the door. If you're sleeping, you should be given a reasonable time to get up and answer the door. If that doesn't happen, if the opportunity for that doesn't happen, and I think taking the testimony as a whole, not only from Jackie Molina, but also from the defendants, it's quite clear that she did not, the knock and announce, even if it was given, and we're not conceding that it was, but even if it was given, was not adequate to prevent the destruction of the property vis-a-vis the two doors that they destroyed at one time, and the unnecessary disruption of her life and her kids without giving them an opportunity to get up. When you look at the timing that the officers said they gave for the knock announce, they admitted themselves that there was 5 seconds between the last knock and the time they busted the doors down. After midnight, that's just not a reasonable amount of time, especially when there's absolutely no evidence or indication that there's a problem going on inside the house. The third issue that I'd like to deal with is the use of the concussion bombs, which we already touched upon. And the two points I'd like to make in connection with. First, Robbie Dowell, who was a member of the search team but not the entry team, testified at his deposition that at the preliminary briefing before the entry was done, the officers discussed using a concussion bomb at that point. So at that point, if that's when the decision was made to use the concussion bomb, the inference is that there was no reasonable objective need to use a concussion bomb, which is going
to... Well, how would you like to open a basement door and walk downstairs in the dark if you thought there was a major drug dealer in the basement?
You know, Your Honor, I don't mean to be... not acknowledging the problems that officers face in their job. But being a police officer is a dangerous job, and you don't approach the job by using the maximum amount of force that you can to obviate an injury. And just like if a man with a bat approached...
Well, what would you do?
I would question the wife and ask where the husband was and see what was going on with him. I would call down there. I would look down there without necessarily going all the way.
Looking down there, of course, that's the dangerous part. If you go down there, you're very vulnerable when you're walking down the stairs.
That may be, but they could have questioned the wife and says, where's your husband? And she could say he's at work, and if they find evidence...
Why should they believe that?
You know, they don't necessarily have to believe that, but if they look around and find evidence consistent with the fact that he's at work now, then it might be enough. Judge, you know, being a police officer is dangerous, but if you see a man with...
Make it more dangerous than it is inherently, do you?
I don't want to make it more dangerous, but if you see a man with a baseball bat 20 yards away saying, I'm going to hit you, and you're a police officer, you don't pull out your gun and you shoot him either. You try and deal with it in an incremental way.
Well, no one was being shot here.
And there was no urgency of getting down in the basement at that moment either. And that's all I'm...
We don't know what damage these concussion bombs do we?
Well, we know in this case what they did. And, you know, they destroyed carpeting in the house and destroyed part of the walls in the house. So I don't know in the abstract what kind of damage they could do, no. The final issue I'd like to...
Well, before you go on, how do you get over the qualified immunity hump?
Well, there's the cases of U.S. v. Fulks and U.S. v. Jones, and they both discussed and they expressed concern with using concussion bombs. And in any event, they both said officers have to be careful when using them.
Right. But express disapproval wasn't until 2000.
That's correct. But nevertheless, and under Hope v. Pulitzer, which is the recent Supreme Court case, if something is obvious, there doesn't have to be a specific case on point. And if it's not objectively reasonable to use something like that, I think the law was clear, even as of the time this happened, that it shouldn't be used. Just like you shouldn't shoot a guy with a baseball bat if you don't have to do it. I think it's the same principle. On the issue of the damage to the car, the court said, the plaintiffs pointed out that it was likely Defendant Cooper who did that. The court said the plaintiffs didn't know who did it, so therefore it's sheer speculation. This is simply incorrect. The plaintiffs did not know who damaged the car because they weren't in the house. They did know their car wasn't damaged before this happened, and the way we got to Defendant Cooper was made pretty obvious by the testimony. The entry team had only the responsibility for entering the house and securing it. The searching officers, of whom Defendant Cooper was one of them, had the obligation to search the premises. Defendant Simonton testified that none of his officers, entry team officers, searched the car in the garage or damaged the car. Defendant Cooper is the only officer that said not only was he in the garage searching where the car was located, but also that he was inside the car and doing a search in the car as well. So circumstantially, I believe we have enough evidence to show that Defendant Cooper was responsible for this. And to say it was just sheer speculation is just not accurate in that context. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Mr. Fisher?
May it please the court, counsel Nadine Wickern on behalf of the defendants appellees. On appeal, the Molinas raised three issues, the first concerning the validity of the search warrant, the second concerning the propriety.
Are there any proceedings against Molina?
Not by the state. The record shows that the state dropped the charges a year after they were filed to let a federal investigation move forward. As far as the record and I know, I'm not aware of anything else since then. Summary judgment was granted on all of the claims and should be affirmed by this court. Turning to the first issue regarding the validity of the search warrant, probable cause was established here. As this court knows, probable cause is a low threshold that looks at whether there's a fair probability that evidence of a crime will be found in a particular place. Under the Frank standard, that is a very difficult standard to meet. We look at whether Officer Cooper intentionally or knowingly or reckless disregard for the truth put false information in or omitted material information from the search warrant affidavit. With regard to the information from Mr. Ramirez, the information was gathered during two interviews with the police 2 months apart. In the interviews, he placed himself at the top of a drug conspiracy with Raul Molina. He described how he picked up the drugs, the cocaine from Raul's home and the marijuana from Raul's cousin's home, how he distributed the drugs and collected the money. All of the statements that he gave were reliable in that, first, the statements he gave were against his penal interest by implicating himself in the conspiracy. This was clear from the search warrant affidavit that he was implicating himself, and judges are aware that usually when individuals give information about drug conspiracies implicating themselves, that they often do that with the hopes of receiving leniency in charges against them. So even if this information were in the search warrant affidavit, the finding of probable cause would not have been altered by the court. Also, this court gives great deference to the court that issues the warrant affidavit, and warrants are presumed to be valid. Furthermore, the inconsistencies that the Molinas point to regarding the drugs that Ramirez said he distributed, I'd like to point out to the court that when the interview first began, Officer Cooper asked, you know, how many ounces of drugs, how many kilos do you distribute per week? Ramirez started out by saying he distributed about 1 kilo per week. As the conversations went on, he explained that the amount that he distributed depended on the demand. He would just get calls to say, you know, who needed drugs and how much they needed, and he would pick them up. I think it's pretty clear from the totality of his statements that he was describing a situation that was fluid. In fact, he said that it wasn't like clockwork. He would just get a call, and then he would pick up the drugs. With regard to his statements that he distributed 27 ounces, that was in a particular situation. Officer Cooper asked Ramirez, who were the major people you supplied to? He named Brian and Jimmy Munteen and also a gentleman named Bob Scheiwert. He said he distributed 1 to 2 ounces to each of them about 3 times a week. The former worked at a bar, and he would take the drugs to them. The officers then extrapolated that that was approximately 3 ounces 3 times a week, which meant 9 ounces, times 3 is 27, and that's where that number came from. A lot of the quotes that the Molinas place in their reply brief, if you look a little bit further, it will explain the context. I believe the district court was correct in saying that often these quotes were taken out of context. About the kilo of cocaine being in the basement, that was a statement that was made, and the statement that is quoted in the brief refers to Ramirez being confused about whether he's talking about what he's seen in Raul's house or in his cousin Reyes's house. So if the court reads a little bit further, that would be cleared up. Furthermore, there's no evidence here that Officer Cooper put this information in the search warrant affidavit intentionally or knowingly or with reckless disregard. And furthermore, the information was corroborated by the garbage search that Officers Cooper and Dale did of the Molina's garbage. They tested many items, and they tested positive for the probable presence of cocaine. Given the statements of Ramirez in the search warrant affidavit and the garbage search, there was probable cause to issue the warrant. Turning to the issue of the propriety of the knock and announce, there's no dispute that there was a knock and announce, and the Molinas have failed to prove their claim.
Why did they make the search at night, and why did they want? Why were they hoping that Molina himself would be there? Wouldn't it be easier to do it during the day when he's not there?
That may well be true. There's nothing in the record, but my assumption would be they had information that he was going to get home at 11. They probably figured there would be some activity at home. He would just be getting home, and maybe the element of surprise and that sort. My understanding is often search warrants are executed in the later hours to avoid injury.
Seems the opposite. I mean, I don't understand. You think it's more likely to lead to injury. The more people are at home, and then they're asleep, they're disoriented, they don't know whether he's the police or they're other drug people or what? Seems a funny rationale, but anyway.
There's nothing in the record, but my assumption is that the risk of having somebody awake with a gun by their side, engaging in activity, especially
when you're arguing against any knock and announce, right? Because if they knock and announce, then the person wakes up, and if he has the gun by his side, he's all set.
Well, there would be the time between the knock and then the entry.
Precisely. Right?
There would be a reaction time.
To wake up people, and then they're awake, they grab their guns. So, the logic of your argument is that there shouldn't be any requirement of announcing because that gives people a chance to arm themselves.
I certainly don't mean to suggest that. And in this case, there was a knock and announce. Jackie's deposition testimony failed to prove that there was not an announce. It did not conflict with Simonton's testimony. Furthermore, the claim on appeal that a reasonable amount of time was not given between the knock and the entry, this court's decision in United States versus Jones, which is very similar to this case, held that a similar time frame was constitutional under the Fourth Amendment. Turning now to the claim about unreasonable damage, with regard to the Molina's evidence about who damaged the truck, The search warrant authorized a search of the garage and a search of any vehicles. Cooper did say that he was in the garage and that he searched the truck. In his deposition, nobody asked him specifically whether he tore apart the middle console. Nobody asked whether it was that way before. There's just simply a failure proof on this to connect Cooper. The inferences that are asked to be drawn would be reasonable if there was some evidence that he,
Well, your opponent said the evidence eliminated everybody except Cooper.
There was evidence that other people were in the garage at different times, but, there was nothing. They never asked him in his deposition. They asked him if he stood on the hood. He said no. They never asked him anything about the inside of the truck. He said he searched in there. I would just submit that there's a failure of proof. There was no question. The fact that there's no denial, there's no proof, there's no dispute that would stave off the granting of summary judgment.
But the damage was in the car or truck or whatever it was?
The Molinas say that there was a dent on the hood and that the middle console was torn apart of the inside.
Well, if the middle console was torn apart and if Cooper was the only person who searched, why isn't that enough evidence to point the finger at Cooper?
It may well be if there hadn't also been other officers who searched the garage. And furthermore, I would admit that
they didn't enter the car. How could they damage the console if they didn't enter the car?
Again, the deposition testimony of the other officers, they were never asked the question of whether they were in the car. And furthermore, I would submit that the damage done to the truck was not constitutionally unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. Similarly, the damage done to the carpet by the two flashbang devices.
Now, what are these things exactly, these concussion bombs?
The record shows that they are little devices that are thrown. They create a bright light and make a noise. I believe this court's discussion of them in United States versus Folks and United States versus Jones suggests that if they would hit someone, there could be damaged, but there's nothing in the record that shows their impact if they hit somebody. And in this case, they
did not. Are they called concussion bombs?
My understanding from the record is they were referred to as flashbang devices. Mm-hmm. I think I've seen concussion bombs before, perhaps in some cases, but I'm not aware, particularly in the record, where it was called concussion bombs.
Getting back to your knock and announce argument for a minute, are you standing on your waiver argument?
Yes.
Okay, you didn't mention that when you went over that, and I didn't know if you had abandoned it or...
No, I believe I had discussed on appeal the...
Right, it was in your brief.
Oh, and here, whether the amount of time was reasonable. We believe that the Molinas have waived that. They did not raise it before. And the fact that we did not raise it on summary judgment doesn't preclude their waiver. If they could have, in response, said we also raised a claim that you did not wait a reasonable amount of time, they did not do so. Unless this court has any other questions, I ask you to please affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. Mr. Fox?
Could you respond to that waiver argument?
I can, and it came up in a funky sort of fashion. When the defendants made their motion for summary judgment, they didn't talk about the length of time. They just said, we made this knock and announce. They didn't talk about the length of time. So in responding to the summary judgment motion, my client, Jackie, testified. She was the one that was home with her two children. She testified. She testified she was sleeping. She didn't hear a knock and announce. So we didn't get into discussing the timing. We addressed with what they said, whether it was knock and announce or not. Jackie said there was no knock and announce. In their statement, and that's how the briefing went, because we, as Celotex provides, we could just respond to what they bring up. Then in the Rule 56.1 statement of facts, they did bring up the timing and said there was this time lapse, and we denied it. Again, referring back to Jackie's testimony, saying, well, she didn't hear any knock and announce, so how can we talk about the time? So they didn't bring it up in the summary judgment, and then what the judge did was he brought it up, really made an issue out of it for the first time in his ruling. And so we didn't bring it up because they didn't bring it up, except in the 56.1 statement, And then the judge brought it up in his ruling, and then we addressed it because of the way it was brought up in his ruling. So I don't believe we waived an argument because we were never knowingly put on notice that that argument was there to start with. Just quickly going back to the arguments about Ramirez, I was accused by the judge in the district court of misquoting and taking out of context, and now it's happening again. And I said in my briefs, and I stand here today before you, and I say the same thing. I urge you to read the statements, because in the briefs...
Your briefs don't contain the statements in full.
The statements are 100 pages long.
Right.
I quoted as extensively as I could within my page limitations.
You quoted the parts that helped you, and the argument is that you didn't put them in context because, you know, one Ramirez is talking about one thing, one point, another thing, another point.
Judge, there's nothing more I can do than ask the court in my briefs and in front of you to say, read the statements, here's the quote, it's not supported. I've tried to do everything I can. And if I may just have another minute to finish. When counsel says Mr. Ramirez says 27 ounces in the statements, it's not there. And in his very first statement that he gave, he specifically said he gave a range of 3 to 7 ounces, and that was very specific. And then that changed wildly. And then finally, just with respect to Defendant Cooper, Mr. Simonton, the head of the entry team, did specifically say that he was in the garage and that with his other officers and that nobody damaged the truck, and that negated everybody else. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Fox. Thanks to both counsel. Case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to